Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sergio Moncada, co-founder of Hondurans for Democracy, who assesses the legitimacy of the November 29th presidential election in Honduras, overseen by that nation's coup-installed government. Alden Meyer, director of strategy and policy with the Union of Concerned Scientists, who reports on the issues being debated at the UN Climate Change Conference in Copenhagen, Denmark. And Corey Wright with the media reform group Free Press, who explains why a national coalition is organizing opposition to the proposed merger between cable TV giant Comcast and NBC Universal. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
North Korea created a financial panic recently when it suddenly devalued its currency, the won, and limited exchanges for new currency. Officially, the move to revalue the won, the most dramatic in 50 years, was done to clamp down on inflation and curb growing street markets. In the process, it made existing currency, stashed away by a growing merchant class, essentially worthless. Lee Seung-yong of the South Korean solidarity group Good Friends told the Associated Press, "We heard business and market activities were all suspended. People have no more money to engage in business." Meanwhile, members of the North Korean political elite have protected their fortunes by converting their funds to foreign currencies such as the U.S. dollar, the euro, and the Chinese yuan. Analysts in South Korea see the devaluation of the won as a way for the regime to regain control of growing street markets that were established to alleviate hunger. These markets also sell banned items like films and soap operas from South Korea. North Korea battled severe famine during the mid-1990s when 2 to 3 million people died of hunger. The Boston Globe reports that the Obama administration has missed a deadline to declassify historic foreign policy documents, including descriptions of abuses committed by the CIA during the Cold War. The documents in question, all over 25 years old, were set to be declassified by December 31st this year under an order signed by Bill Clinton in the 1990s. President Obama ordered an extension of the deadline due to U.S. intelligence agencies' opposition to release of the material. Meredith Fuchs of the National Security Archive, a private group that researches and publishes declassified documents, observed, "The national security bureaucracy is deeply entrenched and not willing to give up some of the protection they feel they need for their documents." While Obama has called for the establishment of a national declassification center to speed up release of documents, the missed declassification deadline has raised concerns among advocacy groups seeking greater transparency in government activities. The House of Representatives has voted to extend the nation's soon-to-expire estate tax. The law imposes a 45% tax rate on all individual estates valued over $3.5 million and $7 million for couples. The vote marks the first battle over Bush-era tax cuts that are all set to expire in 2010. The Senate will likely temporarily extend the current law before it, too, debates the future of the estate tax sometime in early 2010. If Congress had not acted, the estate tax would have been eliminated in 2010 and reinstituted in 2011 with a 55% tax rate on all estates over $1 million. While most Republicans oppose what they disparagingly call the death tax, Democrats, like Colorado Congressman Jared Polis, have insisted that an estate tax is necessary to prevent the nation's wealthy from becoming an entrenched permanent aristocracy. According to the Tax Policy Center, less than 1% of all estates in the U.S. are now required to pay the estate tax. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Richard Hill.
A presidential election overseen by the coup-installed government of Honduras continues to generate controversy, with most governments around the world refusing to recognize the victor. Porfirio Lobo, the winning candidate representing the Conservative National Party, is scheduled to be sworn into office on January 27th. Prior to the November 29th vote, a U.S. brokered agreement unraveled that was to have restored Honduran President Manuel Zelaya to power and establish a national unity government to supervise the election. When the pre-election accord fell through, Zelaya, who had taken refuge in the Brazilian embassy in the Honduran capital, urged his supporters to boycott the vote. Initially, the coup regime reported that 65% of Honduran voters participated in the election. But after press reports contradicted that figure, the number was reduced to 49%. While the majority of Latin American and Caribbean nations have condemned the election in Honduras as illegitimate and illegal, the Obama administration, along with allies Panama and Costa Rica, have broken with the rest of the hemisphere by recognizing the election results. José Miguel Insulza, Secretary General of the Organization of American States, called for the immediate establishment of a government of national unity with the participation of Zelaya to prevent the new president from receiving his command from those responsible for the coup d'etat. Between the lines, Scott Harris spoke with Sergio Moncada, co-founder of the group Hondurans for Democracy. He describes the human rights abuses and repression directed at those opposing the coup, which in his view made it impossible to conduct a free and fair election on November 29th.
In the eyes of many Hondurans and a very, very large portion of the international community, the elections seemed to be nothing more than an effort to whitewash the June 28 coup d'etat. There were a number of circumstances. First, between June 28 and the elections, there have been 4,000 human rights violations, which the coup regime control media in country and the international media have not reported on. In addition to that, you've had numerous cases of the press and the media being shut down just over the weekend, for example. One independent newspaper was shut down by the military and police. And just by the very fact that you had the democratically elected president of a nation, practically a prisoner in the Brazilian embassy in Tegucigalpa, Honduras, with snipers pointing guns at him 24/7, those circumstances are not at all what you would call the ideal situation for free and fair elections.
Sergio Moncada, tell us about Porfirio Lobo. Does he have fingerprints on this coup d'etat, and what kind of leader do you think he'll make here, having won election in a very dubious set of political circumstances and his legitimacy questioned by most of the world?
Well, he does have very, very, very close relationships with the business and political elite that were the intellectual architects of the coup. Interestingly enough, for the time between the coup on June 28 and the November elections, he very cleverly distanced himself from the coup as opposed to the other major party candidate who had to fight the stigma of being a coup monger. Lobo was very, very clever in distancing himself up to a point, but not fully, and therefore grabbing some of the votes of people who were opposed to the coup, but who were not necessarily supporters of President Zelaya. I don't think the country will undergo any changes under him. The first few months of the Lobo administration in Honduras will be, to say the least, extremely difficult, just by the mere fact that he will not have the immediate recognition of many key countries in the region. Brazil is a key player right now. Brazil is an emerging world power. Internally, too, he's facing an ever-growing resistance of people who, like myself, believe that this was the election was nothing more than an effort to whitewash the June 28 coup d'etat.
Now, what about Manuel Zelaya himself, who's holed up in the Brazilian embassy? What's his next move? Has he made any statements following the November 29th election and what his plans are?
He hasn't made any specific statements. We know from the resistance from the National Front Against the Coup that they have stopped asking for his being put back in power as one of the key requirements. And the key leaders of the resistance have said that they will respect any decision that President Zelaya takes. One of the key steps for the resistance for the National Front against the coup is to continue the fight for the very reason that got President Zelaya ousted. He wanted to move forward with something called the Constituent Assembly in order to redraft the Constitution and make it a little more participative. What Zelaya wanted was to lift those restrictions and give the people a voice in matters like trade, for example, and how trade affects unions, or the rights of underrepresented groups, minorities, women, indigenous groups. And so we'll see a push for a constituent assembly from the resistance, and perhaps also from the United States, because they might see that as a chip to be bargained. I think one possible scenario that's being talked about is that when President-elect Lobo comes to office, he might offer to not push for the false charges that President Zelaya is being charged with, in the spirit of bringing certain portions of the country together. Right now, the country is extremely polarized to the point where, personally, myself, I've stopped talking to friends and family who are supporting the coup, because to me, it's inconceivable that people can do that. And I represent just a tiny piece of what's going on in the country. It's quite polarized to the point that many people are mentioning the possibility of a civil war. If there are no olive branches on the part of President-elect Lobo, especially towards President Zelaya, we might indeed see the start of a civil war.
That was Sergio Moncada, co-founder of the group Hondurans for Democracy. For more information on the situation in Honduras, visit the website hondurasresists.blogspot.com. Thousands of government officials and environmental activists from around the world created a huge carbon footprint when they flew to Copenhagen for the 15th United Nations Climate Change Conference from December 7th through December 18th. At the conference, conflicts among developed and developing nations will be addressed about how to reduce carbon emissions, called mitigation, and how to pay for ways for the poorest and most vulnerable countries to survive the inevitable consequences of climate change, referred to as adaptation. Decisions about the mechanisms to reduce emissions, most likely a cap-and-trade system, but possibly some form of taxation and consumer rebate, will also be addressed. One of the most frustrating aspects of the problem for environmental activists is that the goalposts have been moved. Research from the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change determined a few years ago that the safe limits of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere could be reached by reducing carbon emissions 20% below 1990 levels by the year 2020, and 80% below those levels by 2050. But now, world leaders are basing their proposals on emissions from 2005, which saw a huge increase over 1990 levels. So, President Obama's pledge that the U.S. would reduce emissions 17% by 2020 translates to only 4% based on 1990 levels. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Alden Meyer, Director of Strategy and Policy with the Union of Concerned Scientists and a 20-year veteran activist on climate change issues. Reached at the Copenhagen summit, he responds to the latest summit proposals and discusses some reasons for optimism.
The reality is, because we've done so little over the last decade and a half, we're currently about 15% above 1990 levels. We think we can actually go much deeper than the administration or Congress are talking about in the U.S. We've done an analysis showing we can get at least a 26% reduction below 2005 levels, which is somewhere around a 12%, 13% reduction below 1990 levels by 2020. The reality is, though, we've done so little in the last decade and a half, it's going to take us a while to catch up to the rest of the world. And in the meantime, we need to design policies also that generate money to help developing countries, for example, reduce emissions from cutting down the rainforests, reduce emissions from installing more inefficient coal plants, and help them get on a path that reduces their carbon emissions growth as they grow their economies. So it's not just what we can do at home. Because we've taken so long to get going, we also have to extend a helping hand to help the global south get its house in order and grow its economy without increasing emissions. And you know, if you do that and you have the offers that are on the table now and you push them up another level, we can get on a path that's consistent with avoiding the worst impacts of climate change, but we are right at the edge.
What were some of the kinds of things that UCS is calling for to reduce energy use that the government isn't talking about?
Well, it's much greater energy efficiency measures, building efficiency, vehicle efficiency. It's a much higher requirement on electric utilities around the country that they generate more of their electricity from clean, renewable energy resources, wind, solar, geothermal, biomass, and a whole host of other measures. And the reality is there's no question that we can get much deeper reductions on a technical basis. And our analysis shows actually that because of the savings that you get by using energy more efficiently, you could end up saving each consumer household about $900 a year by 2030 through this strategy. So it's at net savings to consumers. The problem, of course, is you've got pretty organized resistance from the domestic fossil fuel industry, the coal companies, the oil companies, and others, who make their money off of selling conventional fossil fuels. And the reality is, in the kind of scenario we're talking about, their market share goes down pretty dramatically over the next 10 or 20 years, and that's something that they're fighting very fiercely.
I read something really interesting recently, that in 2008, for the first time, more investments were made in renewable energy than in fossil fuels. That sounds pretty hopeful. Does that sound right to you?
It's true that the market for clean energy renewable technologies has been exploding. It's not only because of concern about global warming. It's also policies in countries like the U.S. in the state level, Germany, Spain, India, China, to provide incentives for clean energy technologies. And also the costs of these technologies, wind, solar, others, have been dropping. So they have been taking off, and there's been a slowdown in investment in fossil fuels because of uncertainty about prices and about future policies on coal, for example. So there has been a crossover, but to keep that going, you really have to have strong federal, state, and international policies that provide incentives for continued investment in those technologies.
Alden Meyer, just a month or so ago, things were looking really grim around the Copenhagen meeting, with world leaders saying in advance that no binding agreement would come out of it, and President Obama wasn't even going to go. Now he's going at the end of the talks, which is the key time, and the U.S., China, and India have all put opening bids on the table about the carbon reductions they're willing to pledge. And, you know, while the amounts are sort of pathetic and nowhere near what's needed, some people consider these proposals as all moves in the right direction. As someone who's worked on this issue for decades, are you at all optimistic now about progress?
Well, it is kind of a good news, bad news strategy. The good news is that President Obama and over 100 other world leaders, including most of the major country leaders, are coming to Copenhagen the end of next week to try to get a deal. The bad news is countries are still a long distance apart on what that deal should look like. And it's not only the issue of industrialized country targets. It's also what developing countries need to do. It's what kind of financing and technology support can be on the table to help developing countries make the transition away from a carbon-intensive development path. So there's some big issues that have to be resolved still to get the right kind of deal by the end of next week. But I am hopeful. I mean, I have to be hopeful, having worked in this area for 20 years. You have to be an optimist to stay at it. And, you know, I think the fact this is the first time since the Rio Earth Summit nearly 20 years ago that you've had this kind of participation by heads of state and heads of government, which is adding a real sense of political mobilization to these talks that you haven't seen in a long time. It sort of concentrates the mind of the ministers and the negotiators when they know that their presidents and their prime ministers are coming in 10, 12 days down the road.
I understand that young people are all over the Copenhagen conference. Talk about what that means for the future of actually, you know, making significant progress on climate change.
There's a tremendous delegation of young people from around the world, and not just from U.S. And Europe and the other industrialized countries, but from Asia and from Africa, from Latin America. And they really bring an important presence to these negotiations because it's really their future we're talking about and the kind of world we're going to leave to them and their children. So they bring in a very important sort of rallying cry. And they bring a lot of new energy to the process, too. They're indefatigable. They work long hours. They're really learning the ropes. They're going to the briefings. They're blogging. They're sending out emails on Facebook and communicating with their friends and really helping build a lot of pressure on the political system. So it's great to see the youth movement getting stronger and stronger each meeting.
That was Alden Meyer, Director of Strategy and Policy with the Union of Concerned Scientists. Contact the union by calling area code 202-223-6133 or visit their website at ucsusa.org. On December 3rd, General Electric and cable TV giant Comcast announced their intention to merge GE-owned NBC Universal with the nation's largest cable company and residential broadband provider. The proposed $37.5 billion merger would be one of the largest in U.S. history and give Comcast 51% control of the NBC network, including 27 local television stations, dozens of cable channels like CNBC, Bravo, and the Weather Channel, and Universal Studios. Media reform group Free Press, along with the Consumer Federation of America, immediately announced their opposition to the merger, asserting that the deal would pose a serious threat to competition and harm the public interest. The groups are concerned that the deal will raise costs for consumers, reduce diversity of content, and trigger a wave of similar mega-mergers throughout the industry. The Comcast-NBC deal must first be approved by federal regulators. Opponents of the merger feel they may have an ally in the White House, remembering that when he ran for president, Barack Obama called for more government scrutiny of media consolidation. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Corey Wright, policy counsel with Free Press, who explains why a national coalition is organizing opposition to the proposed Comcast-NBC merger.
Most people are generally familiar with both of these companies. Comcast is the nation's largest cable operator and residential internet service provider. It owns multiple cable channels, Style Network, E-Entertainment, and some local sports properties. And then NBC, who's probably the more famous of the two, is the country's oldest broadcaster. It owns multiple local broadcast stations, cable channels like MSNBC and CNBC. And in addition to that, it owns the NBC network, and it also owns movie and television studios and an interest in the online video provider Hulu. So in this merger, you're seeing actually the union of two really, really large companies, the result of which is probably unprecedented, even given all of the recent media consolidation that's happened over the last 10 to 15 years. It's a really significant merger.
The critical issue that I know your group and others are very concerned about, and that is the merger of a content producer like NBC and its studios and all, and this distribution company, this very major national distribution company, Comcast Corporation.
In antitrust parlance, a union of these two companies creates what we call vertical integration. And basically that means that a single company controls almost every single unit of both production and distribution up the chain. That means that you control the content that gets produced, but you can also control how most audiences access that programming. So Comcast, for example, after acquiring NBC, gets all of this great marquee movie and television content, but then because it also controls internet access, cable access, and it will own broadcast stations, will be able to utilize the market power which it will gain from controlling all those components and use it to drive out competitors, make it more difficult for rivals to access programming. And generally what we usually see in that realm is that consumers have fewer choices and oftentimes also have to pay more to access the content because Comcast and NBC will be such a dominant player in the industry.
Corey Wright, tell us about the groups that are lining up to oppose this merger. What's the coalition that you're working with around the country that doesn't want to see Comcast merge with NBC?
Well, you're going to see a lot of groups coming out against this merger from all political stars and stripes, and also ranging from consumer groups to nonprofit advocacy groups to to unions, to even industry players. This merger is going to have a lot of impact. So you're going to see smaller cable providers come out against this. You are going to see groups like Free Press, Media Access Project, Consumers Union, Consumer Federation of America, who are all concerned about access to information and the cost that ultimately consumers would have to pay, coming out against this, and also unions. Employees who work for Comcast and NBC are concerned about what this merger will ultimately mean for them.
Corey Wright, I wanted to ask you about the idea here that these regulatory agencies may try to cut the baby in half, so to speak, by approving the merger but attaching some conditions to it. What might some of those conditions be, and what would be acceptable, if any of them, in terms of the government going forward with allowing this merger to take place?
So you got it exactly right. In reviewing the merger, the antitrust authorities and the Federal Communications Commission are going to look at all the angles of the merger, and they could just deny it outright. The other thing they may try to do is exact conditions that would try to alleviate some of the anti-competitive and anti-consumer problems. But to be honest, the real truth is that in order to alleviate the very real problems of this merger, any conditions would have to be really tough and would probably make the deal considerably less attractive for the companies involved. At bottom, if the government does its job to protect consumers, the merger review is going to be a painful one for NBC and Comcast, and you know, as well it should be. But you know, some of the things that they might consider doing is forcing divestiture of the local broadcast stations, which might ease some concerns about local market concentration. They may require non-discrimination and carriage of independent programming on cable systems owned by Comcast, or make sure that NBC content is available online to competing online video providers. The bottom line is, though, a lot of the things that make this merger so attractive to Comcast and NBC right now is what makes it so dangerous for competition and for consumers. So ultimately, I think if the government does its job and they either deny the merger or exact conditions that will make this deal significantly less attractive for NBC and Comcast.
That was Corey Wright, policy counsel with the media reform group Free Press. Contact Free Press by calling area code 202-265-1490 or visit their website at freepress.net. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756 or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris, with the assistance of Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Richard Hill, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Elaine Osowski.